And I am you.
And you are me.
It's just a crazy storm.
Hi, I'm Peter.
And I'm Felice.
Welcome to Action Packed. On our weekly travel podcast, we interview some amazing people who ventured to the far corners of the world.
We hope you'll feel as inspired as we do by their extraordinary journeys.
So let's go straight to the action. This week, we're celebrating English eccentricity at its very best and talking to cricket fan and self-styled slow cyclist Ollie Broome, who pedalled his way from London to Australia to watch the Ashes. Ollie is the very opposite of those sleek, lycra-clad figures who spend their weekends eating up as much tarmac as they can on super expensive 7-kilo carbon fibre racing bike. When fully laden, his sturdy roadster weighed more than he did. No rush, take your time, says Ollie, and enjoy the journey. These days he's turned tour operator, taking fellow relaxed travellers on two-wheeled adventures through the hillsides of three contrastingly different holiday destinations, Transylvania, Greece and Rwanda. Ollie Broome, welcome to our travel podcast. Now, it's a long way by pedal power on an overladen bike from London to Brisbane. How did this extraordinary journey come about?
First of all, thanks for having me on the show. And you're right, it is a long way. I went for a bike ride at the weekend. It was 20 miles and I wondered how on earth I got to Australia. So it came about because I think I was searching for a bit of meaning in life. I was working at an office at a desk in London, and I felt that everything was a bit too easy and a bit just floating along. And I fancied a bit of an adventure. I didn't really know what that adventure was, but I started reading quite a few travel books. Now, I didn't quite know where I wanted to go. I knew that I needed something to aim for, though, because otherwise I'd just sort of head off into the back of beyond and never come back. So if I had a goal to aim for, I knew that would help me get out of my tent every morning. So I was taking a wander with a friend of mine through a local neighbourhood in London, and she was about to move to Sydney, and she didn't really know a lot about cricket, but had heard the word Ashes before. And when she mentioned the word Ashes, my brain started clicking into gear, and I realised that the Ashes were starting in about 15 months' time. So I quit my job, bought a bike, and started cycling to Australia to go and watch the Ashes.
So what did you take with you on your bike?
I took a lot more than I needed, and I can't quite remember what the items I threw away were. But I know that my mum packed a lot of stuff sneakily into my panniers the night before I left. And then I remember dumping a lot of it in sort of Belgium and France in bins rather than littering the place. But anyway, I mean, it obviously depended where I was. I went through a lot of different sort of climates and landscapes and that kind of thing. So, you know, in Europe, I was cycling through a European winter, October, November, December, January. Carried a lot of, you know, warm clothes, always food to eat in the evenings when I arrived at my destination. I had, you know, really warm four-season sleeping bag. And when I got to hot countries, I didn't need as much kit.
But above all, you had a cricket bat, is that right?
I did have a cricket bat. I actually carried seven cricket bats with me, one at a time, though. So they used to get sent out to me in various parts of the world by a cricket bat company manufacturer that sort of sponsored part of the trip. And so I used to give it to people that I became friendly with, you know, people. Cricket-loving folk in funny parts of the world like Serbia and Hungary and Turkey. And I think they were grateful for a new bat. And then I'd get a new one sent out. And I used it as a chopping board as well for, you know, to chopping onions and that kind of thing in the evening. A doorstop, a battering ram, all sorts of things throughout the year. Yeah, and of course, I, you know, got a chance to practice my forward defence against a wall because I had a tennis ball with me as well. So, I was, you know, Don Bradman-esque, I was practicing my forward defence every now and again.
And the plan was to play cricket in every country you went to along the way, is that right?
Yes, it was. It was, and I failed miserably. I cycled through 23 countries and I played cricket in 19 of them. Four countries I didn't play, I can't remember, but I played cricket in 19. Some pretty unlikely spots as well. You know, I played cricket with the national team of Serbia, the national team of Hungary, and a few of the national team of Turkey and Bulgaria. And obviously I got a lot of cricket in when I cycled across India. So yeah, it was a kind of silly trip, really. I mean, the trip itself was I found quite hard, you know, the cycling, and, you know, in lots of different ways it was challenging. And the cricket was a sort of moment of, you know, always provided that moment of levity.
So you headed out of London and cycled across Kent to the coast. And then you caught a ferry to Dunkirk. And then what? Which way to Australia. I don't recall ever seeing any signposts.
Yeah, I used to ask locals. You have to find ways of amusing yourself. I used to ask locals which way Australia was in the local language. I always learned that, you know, that's the phrase in the local language. It got a bit harder when I got to Arabic-speaking countries and that kind of thing. But, yeah, I used to follow my nose. I mean, if I was heading southeast through Europe, it was generally a good thing. I used to follow the thin blue line on the map because I was pretty unfit. I didn't do any training at all.
What, none at all?
Literally not a single piece of – did not go for a training bike ride. About a year before I left, I cycled to Paris with a friend on a bike I bought on Gumtree or something for 20 quid. And she and I, we took 8 days to get to Paris. It was really, you know, it takes most people about 3 days. It took us 8 days. You know, I suppose my assumption was if I could cycle to Paris, spend 8 days in the saddle, then I could cycle, you know, halfway around the world. If there's a problem on the horizon, I tend to bury it. And then, you know, it either works out or it doesn't. It wasn't a very good idea, of course, because at the end of day one, I was in tears. We also, me and a few mates who'd cycled down from London, about 15 of us, and I was in tears in a bunk bed somewhere in Kent because my knee was hurting so much and I was pretty terrified of not being able to do it. And she just said to me, she was a doctor, Kate, and she said, not all pain is bad. You know, sometimes your body's telling you something, but it'll stop telling you that thing in a few weeks if you get your muscles going and that kind of thing. So, and she was right. About 3 weeks later, I had no more knee pain. And for the rest of the 14 months, I was, you know, had absolutely no ailments at all.
So what was your route? You went Turkey and then into Asia that way? Or what? Where did you go?
Yeah, so I went down through Europe and through Western Europe, obviously Eastern Europe, down to Southeast through Europe. I hit Turkey and went round the Mediterranean and through Syria, Jordan, Egypt, Sudan. And then I flew to Sudan to Mumbai and then across India and down through Southeast Asia. I got another flight from Dhaka to Chiang Mai because I spent about 2 weeks knocking on the door of the Burmese embassy in Dhaka and they wouldn't even talk to me about getting me in there. So and then cycled down through Thailand and Malaysia and Indonesia and got a boat to Australia and then across Australia. Well, across Australia, and that's stretching things. So from Darwin to Brisbane, so that was about 4,500 kilometres.
And then you actually got to watch some of the Ashes.
Yeah, I watched every day. Yeah, I watched every day of the Ashes, and it was a triumphant series for England. We won the series 3-1, which I believe was my prediction when I was on Test Match Special at least one of the occasions during my trip. So I predicted it right.
Did you have any bad experiences on your trip? Did anything go really wrong?
Yes, things did go wrong. Things went wrong on a daily basis, I'd say. I mean, things went right on a daily basis too. But there was always something, you know, going wrong, whether it was like a dog chewing your tire, or you run out of food or this or that. I mean, I suppose my big takeaway from the whole trip was that people are generally good. Like, that in terms of sort of moments I felt in real danger, there were very few indeed. I got pretty ill with dengue fever in Thailand. That was a real low, and I genuinely didn't know if I would sort of be able to finish the trip and certainly get to Australia in time to watch the Ashes. There was a guy in Australia who threatened to run me over and came pretty close. There was a moment I got hit by a wing mirror in Bulgaria and sort of fell down this little escarpment, and I've got the footage of me sort of giving this tearful piece to camera. But you know, they were low points. I mean, there's always someone, you know, hooting encouragement as you're cycling. I remember cycling over the up the hills outside of Sofia, and, you know, people hooting their encouragement as I was cycling up these sort of big mountains. And you know, those were fantastic moments. I'd say I had very few real low moments.
Did you come across any tricky, sort of difficult experiences with wildlife?
So one scary moment in Turkey was when I was cycling along, and it was getting near dusk. And I'd been looking for a place to sleep for quite a while. So I looked up to the left, and I saw some smoke coming out of a little hut on a sort of small escarpment, probably about half a mile away. And as I looked towards it, these shapes started running towards me. I was very soon to find out that they were dogs, big sheep dogs, Kangal dogs. I mean, they're sort of waist high kind of thing. Anyway, they ran towards me and they fanned out and they were following me. I mean, if I looked behind me, there were six or so of them all fanned out behind me and they were getting closer and closer. And I reached the top of this small incline. And I looked behind me and they had stopped. And they were probably about 100 metres behind me at this stage. And I didn't count my chickens. I sort of waited for a bit and didn't know why they'd stopped. Anyway, I eventually got back on the bike and started pedaling down the hill into this village, and I quickly realized why they'd stopped. It's because it was obviously at the edge of their territory and the beginning of the next pack of dogs' territory. Anyway, these dogs started running towards me from the village, and they weren't particularly aggressive in the end, but I ended up jumping off my bike, wheeling my bike about half a mile into town with these huge sheepdogs all around me, and pitched my tent in the village. They disappeared, and I was literally, I was in the middle of a village, just a grass patch, the only grass patch I could find. It was kind of lightly snowing by this stage, and it was very dark. And this chap came and sort of said, you know, effectively, in, I didn't understand what he was saying, but effectively he was saying, what the hell are you doing? And he ushered me towards the mosque. And he was the imam. I found out he was the imam. But he ushered me towards this side bit of the mosque. And he opened the gate, and about 100 turkeys, he ushered them out of this compound. And then opened another door, and there was a room, and it was just full of blankets. And there was a big soba, a big sort of log burner in the middle. And he sort of ushered to me to sort of make my bed there. And then he disappeared. And I thought, well, it's going to be a cold night because there's no wood for the fire. But he came back laden with wood and left me there, and made the fire and left me there. And the nicest finish to a day after that adrenaline rush of the dog. So the thing about the Australian outback is that there are so many dead kangaroos. I mean, it's just unbelievable. So I cycled with a Hungarian friend for the last 3 weeks through the outback. And we reckon that we saw a dead kangaroo every 10 metres. The outback really is sort of, to me, is the stench of death. And when you, because you know, dead cows and dead all sorts of things, snakes and everything out there. And after I finished, I got the train across the Nullarbor Plain from, I think it was from Melbourne or Adelaide, across to Perth. And, you know, you're looking out at this vast expanse of nothing, and it's, you know, beautiful in its own way, but you can't smell anything. You can't feel the place. And I did, you know, although that the smell of death wasn't necessarily nice, at least it means you sort of, you're getting a sense of what the place is like, you know, how inhospitable it is. And I remember that feeling sitting on the train thinking this, you know, this is pretty rubbish. I'd rather be out there cycling across it, even if the wind is making me only be able to cycle 5 kilometres an hour.
Now, how much did your bike weigh when laden?
At one point, it was heavier than I was. At one point, it was 69 kilos, and I was 65. That was in Sudan. And by the way, now I'm 90 kilos. And when I left, I think I was about 82 or 83. So I lost a lot of weight.
And you had a lot of water, presumably. You took water with you.
Yeah, so a lot of that weight was water. I think when I weighed the bike, it was on some scales getting onto a boat in Aswan, or getting off a boat in Wadi Halfa, I think it was, in Sudan. Yeah, my bike had probably something like 30 litres of water on, so it was a lot. So water was always responsible for most of the weight.
So do you follow roads all the time, or did you go off-road as well?
I went off-road a fair bit. I mean, one of the things about the type of cycle touring that I did, I suppose, on that trip, was that I was most of the time following main roads, because I sort of felt a slight urgency to crack on with things. And I suppose if I hadn't set that goal of getting to Australia in time for the Ashes, I might have done more. So, you know, quite often I'd be cycling past a UNESCO site, but it was 50 kilometers off the main road, and so I'd think, oh, am I going to do it? That's another day, basically. So I'd sort of stick on the main road. There were times though when I did get off properly off beaten track. In Australia, for example, coming down the Stuart Highway from Darwin, the road trains were just, I mean, they were threatening to kill me. I mean, they were horrible, pushing me off into the dust occasionally. And if the wind was the different ways, they'd suck you in and it would feel like you were going to hit them. So that wasn't very nice. So there I really sort of headed east towards the Gulf of Carpentaria, headed down the Barkly Tablelands. And yeah, you're properly off the beaten track there. There was a great moment where I was cycling along. I'd been pushing my bike for much of the day through sort of sand that was a good few inches thick. And I was on my bike when this truck came up and they just stopped next to me. And the guy who was driving, he was in the front with two others, and it was a flatbed truck. And he just leaned across his mates and he said, "You fucking stupid bastard." And he just, with no, he didn't say anything else. He just got out of his truck and he jumped up onto his flatbed and he opened the freezer that was strapped down onto the back of the flatbed, and he hurled a frozen bottle of water, I mean, almost as hard as he could, at me, and then didn't say anything else, just drove off. And that was sort of outback hospitality for you. The best thing was the next day, that him and his mates came back. I was on the same road, and they were obviously coming back to that. It was a big gold mining area, and I suspect that's what they were doing. And he just very quietly pulled up beside me, didn't say a word, handed me another water bottle, and we had a good chat. A nice chat rather than just a sort of off the cuff, hurling abuse at me. I cycled the last 3 weeks with a Hungarian friend that I made. I made friends with him in Budapest. He'd actually made a film about my whole trip and had said when I left Budapest that he wanted to come with me on the ride, but he just got engaged. Sorry, just got married. Anyway, he flew out to Australia and cycled the last 3 weeks with me. And we were cycling along one day and this car came towards us. And as they went past, these two girls waved and we got quite excited. Hadn't really seen any girls for a few weeks. I hadn't anyway. And anyway, the next day, same car comes past, a bit like the Australians threw the water bottle at me. Same car comes past the other way, heading back towards the coast, same direction as us. So we ushered them to stop and we chatted to them and they were nice. One of them was called Naomi. I can't remember what the other one's called. Lotsy wanted to do some filming, so he jumped in the back of their car and filmed me as I was cycling along. So he did that, and then they gave him a lift back to his bike, and then they drove off, and then he was going to catch up with me. But as they drove past me, Naomi got out the roof of the car and took her top off and said, "We love you guys!" it was quite funny. It was quite amusing. Anyway, about 3 weeks later, I arrived in Brisbane at the Brisbane Cricket Ground, and my mum was waiting there. My dad had flown out from the UK. They'd both flown out from the UK, and my first ever cricket coach was there to welcome me. Anyway, standing next to my mum was Naomi the Flasher. I couldn't believe it. She was literally chatting to my mum as I arrived. And I had no idea how I had not been in touch with her at all. It was just a very strange moment.
And did you sleep in a tent, in your tent every night?
No, absolutely not. I can't claim to have slept in my tent every night. I did carry my tent all the way. I probably, if I was on the road for 412 days, I probably camped about 200 times. Because in somewhere like India, I was there in April, May, where it's kind of 40 degrees during the daytime and not much cooler at night. So I stayed in, and you're paying £1 or £2 for a really cheap bed in a roadside dubba. So I did that. I was camping just south of Calcutta on a beach, right in the middle of the beach. Hadn't really seen anyone. And I was fast asleep. I heard this noise outside. It was actually the zip of my tent opening. And I sort of woke up, adjusted to the light. And there was this man, I can't quite remember his wording, but he essentially told me he was a customs officer and that I should get off the beach. And as he was doing that, he was leaning through my tent. He reached into the top pocket of his shirt. He reached for a comb and he got it out and he brushed his hair. And brushed his hair and then carried on telling me that I should leave the beach. I will never forget that. Very strange situation. Anyway, sort of 2 o'clock in the morning, I had to pack up all my things and my tent and everything and cycle back off the beach. And I camped sort of under the edge of a temple. And woke up at about 4 o'clock because, everyone in the village was up and about. And this family took me to their house for breakfast. I wasn't very happy with the customs officer, but it was something good came of it.
So did lots of people befriend you like that and take you to their house and things like that? Or?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That was, the memory for me is spending time in people's houses, shops and all sorts of places that they owned. Particularly in Islamic countries, I found, I had no concern that I wouldn't find somewhere to sleep. Whereas in India, I did always worry. I mean, I cycled well into the night in India quite often looking for somewhere to sleep. But in an Islamic country, I just was never worried because I just knew that I could either camp in the middle of nowhere or if I was near people, I would be taken in. I mean, it was as simple as that. My first night in Syria, I just crossed the border from Turkey. And I was cycling along and pickup truck pulled up behind me and two men in black, full length black trench coats got out of the car and they introduced themselves to me. And one of them had just been working in Saudi Arabia for 10 years as a civil engineer. And he seemed like a nice guy. And he said to me, you know, where are you staying tonight? Would you like to stay with my family? So I thought, yeah, why not? So I followed them into town, about a mile into town. And we went to a shop front. And it turns out sort of his, I can't remember quite what they sold, but anyway, the shop was pretty much empty. And then their house was sort of behind, linked in. And I slept in the shop window. Over quite a busy town in northern Syria. But I got taken around to lots of their friends' houses. It's very, very sad to think what's happened to that town, Marat al-Numan. I think it was in the early days of the Syrian conflict. It was right at the centre of things.
During your journey to Australia, how many punctures?
Oh, well, I didn't count my punctures, I'm afraid. But I can tell you when my first one was, and it was in Turkey, and it was caused by a dog. Amazingly, I got through the whole of Europe, or pretty much the whole of Europe, with not even a puncture. And frankly, I can't even remember a time when I had to pump up my tyre. And then after that, certainly most weeks, and if not, sort of on a daily basis. But I very rarely had to fix a puncture myself. It's amazing how often you're near people cycling along, you know, around the world. So many times I would get a puncture and someone would grab it off me, take it to the local tyre repair shop and just fix it for me. I must have fixed about probably 10 punctures myself, and I probably had about 50 in total.
What about washing clothes? How did you manage that?
Yeah, I didn't bother washing. Yeah. No, I did. I think that was one of the things actually that my mum gave me was washing powder. That I quickly got rid of. I mean, I had various people to stay with throughout Europe, for example, you know, people involved in cricket in various countries. I'd arranged to stay with friends of a friend of a friend in West, you know, in Belgium. So, that, you know, there were always people that I could, well, it sounds like I'm just a cheapskate, doesn't it? But people I could use their washing machines. So, yeah, that's what I did. I mean, I did give away quite a few clothes as well and that kind of thing.
Going back to the cricket, how did these various countries know you were coming? Because, I mean, Austria and Serbia are not particularly well known for their cricketing profile worldwide. How did they know you were coming, and had you been on radio in England or something?
So those the people who organise cricket in these various countries across Europe, I had written to them to ask, you know, to sort of introduce myself and see if I could play cricket in their country. And they were all incredibly enthusiastic about me visiting them. Which I was really excited about. I did find them enthusiastic when I arrived, but they had all been coerced into hosting me. I later found out Vladimir, the self-appointed general secretary of the Serbian Cricket Federation, told me he admitted that he'd actually been forced into it. I think he felt like he was able to tell me because we actually became quite good mates. You know, sort of 10 years later, we're still in touch. So yeah, that's how that happened. Yeah, it was great. I mean, it was extraordinary meeting. You know, Vladimir and Harris, probably two of the most enthusiastic, passionate cricket lovers I've ever met. And they are, you know, fully fledged Serbs and residents of Belgrade, you know, have no connection to the UK apart from Harris worked here for a few years, you know, and they love this game. You know, it's just extraordinary. And they had no cricket ground in Serbia. They do now, but at the time they had no cricket ground. So they had to play. We played within the walls of this fortress, you know, and the wicket was a path, you know, tarmac path. I mean, it was, yeah, quite something.
So then, having watched the Ashes and seen victorious England, what happened then?
After England won the Ashes, I headed home and didn't have a clue what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. One of the purposes of going on the trip was to figure it all out, find more meaning. I probably hadn't really, you know, I'd sort of, you know, just had fun, just had a great trip, done a lot of thinking, but hadn't really decided what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. So I debunked down with various mates in London for about 9 months. And during the course of that 9 months, managed to get a book deal. So tied me over for a few months and got writing the book. And while that was happening, I found a job advert for this role in Rwanda. So I got sent this job ad in Rwanda by a friend who perhaps knew that I was searching for some meaning as well, and obviously knew that I loved cricket. So, and it was a job to sort of lead the project to build the first international standard cricket ground in Rwanda, which had been started by a guy who had then very sadly died. And I get on. I just thought, well, this sounds, you know, this sounds great fun. It sounds like a project. I sort of looked into it a bit more. At first, my first impression was Rwanda and cricket. I'm not sure that sounds particularly necessary or required, but I dug into it and it did sound like a great project. And I moved out to Rwanda. Yeah, I spent 2 years living out there. And the aim was to provide a home for the cricket community of Rwanda, which was sort of pulling people in from all walks of life. The story of cricket in Rwanda is a great one as well, because cricket was brought to Rwanda by the Rwandese, so not by the English, which in most other cricket playing countries, certainly in Africa, it was brought by the Brit, whereas in Rwanda it was introduced by Rwandans just a few years ago. So it does, you know, it's a nice story.
And then having come back from Rwanda, you decided to set up a tour operation?
I did. I fell in love with bicycle travel when I was on the road. And I decided that, and I'd done a lot of cycling in Rwanda while I was living out there. And Rwanda was really the place that sort of made me think this could be a great idea to take people on much shorter journeys, obviously, than my trip to Australia. But sort of trying to get a similar feel, that sort of feel of uncovering places that are a bit different and perhaps not that visited. And yeah, in 2015, I started welcoming people to, or taking people to Transylvania in Romania. And we've grown from there.
Why Transylvania of all places? That's more Dracula country than cyclist country, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's an interesting one. So I think the first reason Transylvania is because when I was cycling through Eastern Europe, everyone I spoke to or heard from back home was saying, you shouldn't be cycling along the Danube, you should be cycling through Transylvania. You know, it's very beautiful. I say everyone. I mean, this is not many people, but anyone who'd been to Transylvania. I'd always wanted to go there. And then I was just chatting to a friend about the sort of place I was looking for my cycling journeys in Europe that I wanted to take people on. And she'd just been walking there and had an amazing time and described this place as being sort of a land lost in time. Incredibly beautiful architecture, food that was very definition of organic without being called organic, just somewhere, a bit of a time warp. So I went and I found, you know, exactly the place that she described. I just thought, you know, it is the most magic place. If I'm honest, we've struggled ever since to find somewhere that matches it. I think we've done it now and we sort of cracked it. I mean, I'd never been involved in travel, so I really threw myself in at the deep end. I decided to run a few trips in 2015 and then decide if it was a goer. And at the end of 2015, my wife and I decided that the following year we would go and live out there and sort of get to know, yes, the place, but also how to run a travel company. So we did. We went to live in a tiny village in the middle of nowhere. My wife was pregnant, so she spent most of her pregnancy out there. And yeah, it was great. And we sort of felt like whenever people came to visit, paying guests, that we were sort of showing them our little corner of paradise. It was great. And we've gone from there, really.
Cycling for the guests is slow cycling, essentially, is it? It's not to turn up in your Lycra and see how far you can go each day.
Yeah, it's absolutely slow cycling. It's a chance to unwind. I think most of our guests have pretty busy lives, and it's just a chance to sort of, just mosey along on a bike. And we do a lot of walking as well. And it's very much not Lycra. Travel at its best is an opportunity to kind of, make people think about their lives back home and, you know, what they want out of it. And I think the best way of doing that is just by slowing down and seeing new places that are sort of particularly different. And that's what we do.
Do you provide the bikes or do people bring their own?
Yeah, we provide everything. I mean, I don't like the word package necessarily, but it is a package. You know, these are definitely holidays for people who perhaps have been independent travelers in the past, you know, that kind of thing. But sort of nowadays, you know, really value a bit of comfort and, you know, well designed, well thought through trips and you know, not having to do too much either because they're for busy people, you know, busy people who just want everything provided. So yeah, we do that. Yeah.
And do people have to book a whole group or can they join a group?
They can join a group. So we the vast majority of our guests come as private groups of around sort of 6 to 12 people. And then we run sort of a limited number of scheduled trips each year that people can join as obviously singles or twos or threes or fours. And they're often the most fun, actually.
What if someone wants to come on an e-bike? Can they do that?
Yeah, absolutely. So about 60% of our guests these days use e-bikes. I mean, the growth in e-bikes has been a really, it's been a great trend for us. I mean, it's sort of hit at the right time. And it just opens up, you know, experiences to lots of our guests who wouldn't necessarily be able to cycle off into the forests of Transylvania on a dirt path, age 60 or whatever they are. and they now can. So it's been amazing. Yeah,
we're huge e-bike fans. We started doing this in Austria some years ago, then we came back and we bought our own bikes, and we've been back to Austria and to France, and it's really good fun.
They're quite useful in the Alps because you know it helps go uphill.
Absolutely. I mean, lots of the most interesting places in the world are quite hilly, aren't they? Yeah. You know, there's a reason, you know, we don't do cycling trips. Well, where's flat? I don't know. They're interesting places as well. But anyway, the middle of the outback, perhaps. And so you do need, you know, you do need that extra push. I mean, we do trips in the Land of 1,000 Hills, Rwanda. And, you know, I definitely opt for an e-bike when I go there. It's great. I mean, these trips are all about, you know, shared experiences, friendship, you know, leaving a light footprint, traveling nice and slowly, you know, really high quality of everything. And yeah, they're great fun.
So Rwanda, Transylvania, and any other countries?
Yeah, we go to two parts of Greece. So we started a couple of years ago going to Epirus in northwest Greece, Zagori in particular. And yeah, again, it's sort of a kind of a Greek version of Transylvania, I think. It's a very interesting part of the world. You know, it's got its differences to Transylvania, but it's sort of got that feel. And then we go to the Mani Peninsula on the Peloponnese as well, which is sort of Patrick Leiferma territory where he sort of spent a lot of his life. And we stay. That's a slightly different model. Most of the experiences we take people on are journeys from A to B. But in the Mani, we take over two very nice properties and we spend three nights in each.
So what happens to people's luggage? Do they get, is the luggage taken?
Yeah, we take everyone's luggage. Yeah, absolutely.
And what's the sort of age group of your clients on the whole? Is it people in their 20s or?
No, most of our guests are older. Most of our guests are, you know, 40s plus, I would say. We're not the cheap end of the spectrum, I suppose. And so, you know, that rules out a fair few people, younger folks. I think, you know, that age group of 40s, 50s, 60s really appreciate the little extra touches that we put into everything. There is a lot of detail. It's all about the detail, I think, really. And they really appreciate that. So we seem to have found our niche there. In terms of the people who come, I think they tend to be people who just believe what we believe.
And in recent months, obviously, it's been very difficult.
Yes, it has been tricky. Yeah, to say the least. But firstly, I'm aware that it's very tricky for a lot of people. And so I'm always trying to remind myself of that. But yes, it's not easy having a travel company at the moment. And I think that the main reason is just a lack of clarity.
So how do people book holidays with you?
People tend to get in touch. I mean, have a look at our website, theslowcyclist.co.uk. And then most people like to give us a call. I mean, it's always good to talk and chat things through. People can see our sort of list of upcoming trips on there as well. But if they're looking for something, it's a private, you know, group of 8, 10, 12 people, then they get in touch and we talk them through, yeah, availability and that kind of thing.
Do you have any tips for cyclists or people coming on your trip for the first time?
Well, okay, so a great quote that I really appeals to me, and I can't remember it verbatim, but it's something like, beware any activity that requires new clothes. So, and it was Henry David Thoreau, and I really like that. So you don't need, you know, you don't need brand new Lycra. You don't need, it doesn't mean come scruffy. You can do that if you want, but you don't have to. But it just means, you know, you don't need to buy all the new gear and new Lycra to come on a holiday with us. It's more about the experience and the people and the places. So that's I think that probably gives quite a good sense of what our trips are like. And the last thing is that if you're even considering getting an e-bike, if you come on a trip with us, then get one because you won't regret it.
Ollie Broom, thank you very much for appearing on our travel podcast. And we wish you the very best of luck with your slow cyclist holidays in the future.
Thank you both.
That's all for now. If you've enjoyed the show, do please visit our website, actionpacktravel.com, or subscribe on Spotify, Google Podcasts, iTunes, or another of the many platforms that we're on. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with at least one other person.
And I am you.
And you are me.
It's just a crazy story.